The heat of a Florida summer lingered as the calendar ushered in the first day of fall. Rushing home from school with her mind set to adventure, 13-year-old Gail Joyner put a small snack together and then announced that she was going to take her pet raccoon for a walk, something she did almost every day. Leaving her shoes beside the door, the teen strode out into the shrinking Florida sunlight and seemingly vanished. When her parents couldn't track her down, they called in the authorities, who launched massive searches over the next 3 days. Despite their efforts, they never found even a single footprint. Bloodhounds lost her scent, helicopters and boats combed over land and water, but not a trace of the 13-year-old could be located. Witnesses later came forward, telling the story of the young girl they'd seen talking to a man in a white car. What happened to Gail Joyner that September afternoon in 1972? Had she fallen into the lake? Was she lost somewhere in the surrounding wilderness? Or had the man behind the wheel of that car sped off with the teenager and her pet to an unknown destination? Investigators had no way of knowing that this case would become the oldest unsolved missing child investigation in Hillsborough County. Nearly 50 years later, the answers remain as elusive as they were all those years ago. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 186, The Disappearance of Gail Joyner. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the 1972 disappearance of 13-year-old Gail Joyner, a confusing and baffling case with many twists and turns. Before getting into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit crimecon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. On a warm Friday afternoon in 1972, 13-year-old Gail Joyner went for a walk that she'd taken dozens of times before. This time, however, she never returned, and nearly 5 decades later, her fate remains a mystery. This is episode 186, The Disappearance of Gail Joyner. It was the autumnal equinox, and while much of the country was beginning to bundle up against the cooling winds of a rapidly approaching fall, Florida remained bathed in warm sunshine with a steady cool breeze sailing in from the waves of the Atlantic. It was a long time before computers, cell phones, and tablets kept children secured to their couches, a time where teenagers loved to run free in the golden wilderness of a world rife with excitement and built for exploration, one they believed that was safe, a reality that never was. 13-year-old Gail Joyner, arriving home from school that afternoon, had no plans of hanging out around the house. For the better part of her day, she dreamed of heading out on a walk with her pet raccoon, Bandit. Grabbing a quick snack, the teen snapped a leash onto Bandit's collar and called out to her parents that she'd be back in time for dinner. Running outside, she left her shoes behind as she jogged barefoot towards the wooded road that surrounded Lake Thononassassa. What happened next has been at the core of a difficult and painful mystery. When Gail didn't make it home in time for dinner, her parents grew concerned. Adventurous, intelligent, friendly, and punctual, the teen was always back before the family sat down to supper. When the sun went down and she still hadn't arrived, her parents began to worry. For a young woman who loved swimming in the lake, hunting fish for bandit, and scouring the nearby wilderness for ancient treasures, the dark was the only thing she seemed to truly fear. Assuming she'd gotten lost, or worse yet, injured in some way, her parents climbed into the family car and began searching for her, calling out her name as only their headlights illuminated their rural stretch of road. They never could have imagined that they'd never see their beloved daughter again, or that the truth of her fate wouldn't be discovered in their lifetimes. Just a few hours earlier, their happy family was complete, but now they were entering a nightmare from which they could never awaken. Gail Lorraine Joyner was born on Wednesday, July 22, 1959, in Tampa, Florida, to parents James and Frances. At the time of her birth, Gail was the Joyner's fifth child and second daughter, and over the course of the next few years, the family would welcome two more sons, totaling seven children, five sons and two daughters born between 1954 and 1962. Gail's father, James, was born and raised in the Tampa area, while her mother had been born and raised outside of Detroit, Michigan. The couple were married in October of 1953 and spent their first years living together in the Tampa area. Gail has been described by friends and family as a sweet, kind, and active girl who loved being outside, whether she was playing with friends or just exploring on her own. She made friends easily and was never shy around strangers, with many saying she was extremely outgoing and social. When the youngster wasn't spending time around the house, she could almost always be found taking walks, digging in the flower garden, or swimming with her siblings. According to newspapers of the time, while Gail and her siblings spent a large portion of their childhoods in and around Tampa, at some point the family picked up stakes and moved 1,200 miles north to Franz native Michigan, where they settled in the city of Romulus, a suburb of Detroit. James took a job working for an automotive plant in the city, and for a time everything was going well. Gail attended a local school and, according to her parents, performed well, obtaining good marks and never getting in trouble. Classmates described her as being friendly, outgoing, and well-behaved, with a love for education, but a greater zest for making friends and running around on the playground. While there doesn't appear to be any public documents which pinpoint the exact date that the Joyners moved north, we do have some idea of when and why they decided to leave Michigan, heading back to Florida. In early 1972, when Gail was 12 years old, her father sustained a severe injury while at work. According to local newspapers, an accident at the automotive plant resulted in several toes on one of his feet being severed. This led to James being placed on disability and requiring surgery to try and correct the damage done. Following this injury in March of 72, the family made their move back to Florida, settling in Thanatosasa, a census-designated place and suburb of Tampa, located in Hillsborough County. The family moved to a home located along Thanatosasa Road, which runs along the southern shore of Lake Thanatosasa, which spans more than 800 acres. Being the largest lake in Hillsborough County, Thanatosasa is a popular spot for locals to swim, fish, water ski, and enjoy all manner of water activities. The Joyners happened to settle into a house along the shore of the lake, where a small dock directly across the street gave them constant access to the water. Whether the kids were swimming, going out on the boat to fish with their father, or just looking to skip stones along the water, it seemed like the ideal environment for a family of nine to keep themselves entertained. Arriving back in Florida not long before the start of summer break, Gail got to spend several months exploring the lake, the forestry surrounding it, and the local orange grove just down the street. A lover of animals, Gail was the owner of a very special pet, a raccoon that she named Bandit. Every day, the 12-year-old would attach a leash to the raccoon's collar, and together they'd take a walk around the lake. Gail often referred to this as taking Bandit out for some fresh air. Together, the two would follow the same path, leaving the home and walking towards a small bridge which they'd cross before turning around to head home. Sometimes, however, Gail would lead Bandit down to the shore of the lake where she'd help scoop up fish for him to snack on while she skipped stones. While Gail usually took these trips on her own, with only Bandit at her side, sometimes she'd be joined by one of her brothers or even her older sister. A true child of Florida, Gail would almost never wear shoes unless she had to, and so many of her long trips around the lake were done barefoot. Her mother later told the Tampa Tribune that the preteen loved dipping her toes in the lake and stomping around along the shore as she hunted for snacks for Bandit. During the summer of 72, Gail celebrated her 13th birthday, and as the end of break approached, a new school year loomed on the horizon. In August, the family registered Gail as an incoming student at Greco Junior High School, which had opened just 10 years earlier. Located less than 10 miles from the Joyner home, Gail was looking forward to the challenge of a new school, but mostly, she was excited to make friends. While being a new student could be difficult, Gail never worried, as her bright and welcoming personality usually drew friends in like a magnet. Unfortunately, many of the new bonds formed would be severed prematurely, as the 13-year-old would mysteriously vanish just a few weeks into the school year. The morning of Friday, September 22nd, began as usual. The children in the Joyner home woke up, sat down to have breakfast, and made their way off to school. It was a warm day for the area, with temperatures rising into the high 80s by early morning, and a very slight breeze moving in from the northeast. According to what has been reported, Gail arrived home on time, and for the most part, it was a fairly uneventful day. At approximately 4 p.m., Gail got home from school and quickly went about making herself a sandwich for an afternoon snack. At the time, James and Fran were home, as was Gail's older sister, Linda. According to James, as he was eating lunch, he asked Gail to pour him a glass of iced tea, which she did, before she sat down and began snacking on her sandwich. An hour later, at 5 p.m., Gail told her parents that she was going to take Bandit out to get some fresh air. She asked her sister if she wanted to come along for the walk, but Linda decided to stick around the house. The 13-year-old attached the leash to the raccoon's collar, and before leaving, asked her father if he wanted another glass of iced tea, though he declined. Dressed in a pair of blue jeans and a navy blue pullover, Gail made her way towards the door, stepping out into the Florida sunshine and leaving her shoes behind. Gail apparently added that she might stop by a local store while on her walk. Her parents told her to make sure she was back in time for dinner, and she promised that she would be, but sadly, Gail would never make it back. And what exactly happened that hot Friday afternoon remains a mystery. Both James and Fran later explained that Gail always made it home in time for dinner. So when she didn't make it home by 7, they started to worry. At the time, they didn't think there were any issues and just assumed she'd gotten carried away walking Bandit around the lake. The sky started growing dark, and by 7:30, the sun had set with the evening darkness swallowing the lake as well as the surrounding wilderness. There were few lights along the rural road surrounding the family home, and while Gail was an adventurous teen, she had always been afraid of the dark. By 8 p.m., her parents' concern began to grow into fear, as it was highly unlike Gail to be late, and even less likely that she'd choose to stay out in the dark. Assuming they'd find her quickly, they climbed into the family car and began driving all around the lake looking for the 13-year-old. When they were unable to find her, or anyone who had seen her, they started to worry that she might have been injured or lost. At the time, the possibility that someone had abducted the teen simply wasn't on their radar, and so arriving home around 8:45, James and Fran decided to call the Thanatosasa Volunteer Fire Department to request their help. Several members of the department responded to the call, arriving at Gail's house to get more information about where the teen may have gone and what areas would be best to focus on during the search. Unfortunately, with night having closed in, the darkness surrounding the lake area would make the search far more complicated than they'd first imagined. In hopes of covering a larger area and having a higher chance of finding Gail, the fire department requested assistance from the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. Several deputies arrived to aid in the search, and many of the locals volunteered as well. By 9:30 p.m., 4.5 hours after Gail had left her family's home. More than 100 people were searching along the roads, around the lakeshore, and through the surrounding woods. For several hours, searchers pored over the area, but as time passed, their approach began to shift. While searchers had begun what they believed was simply the search for a teen who may have been lost, the more time passed, the more they began to wonder if perhaps something more sinister had been responsible for Gail's disappearance. Unable to find a single trace of the teenager, the decision was made to call off the search for the night and to reorganize in the morning. Considering the circumstances, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office took the lead and officially categorized Gail's disappearance as a missing persons situation, though at the time, they weren't sure whether foul play had been involved or if Gail had chosen to run off. The Sheriff's Office arranged for a search to begin the next day, Saturday, September 23rd, at 8 a.m. Notices were sent out via television and radio calling for volunteers, especially those who had access to tools which could help widen the search. Specifically, they wanted people who owned boats and horses. While the search was being organized, investigators sat down to speak with Gail's family, while others began canvassing the area for anyone who might have seen the missing 13-year-old in the hours after she left her home. According to her family, Gail was a bright and thoughtful young woman who never got into trouble, was always home by dinner time, and was happy being in Florida. Asked about the possibility she may have run away, both James and Fran were quick to dismiss the theory, noting that she'd never run away before and hadn't given any indications that she wanted to. Investigators began moving away from the runaway theory after speaking with her brother Terry, who was close with Gail. According to him, if she didn't make it home, it had to be because someone had gotten to her. Terry told detectives that his sister was happy where she was and had never given any indication that she'd ever run away. In addition to Terry's comments, investigators noted that Gail hadn't taken any items with her, not even her shoes, and had asked her older sister to take the walk with her, all of which they felt made a runaway scenario highly unlikely. James felt that Bandit, the raccoon, may have played a role in his daughter's disappearance, noting that she was very proud of the pet and was quick to stop and talk to strangers who wanted to get a look at him. He explained to the Times Herald, quote, "That's what got her into trouble. She wouldn't have gotten into a car with a stranger. It would have to be someone she knew. But she's a friendly kid, takes to people easily. She could be lured by small talk about the raccoon. She was always strutting around, showing it off." End quote. Investigators were shown the path Gail most frequently used when walking Bandit, though their search along that way turned up no traces. No footprints, pieces of fabric, or anything to suggest she'd ever even been there. The family also led police to a nearby concession stand that Gail sometimes frequented, but no one had seen her. Outside of her normal routine, Fran told investigators that Gail would sometimes comb through undeveloped areas around their house in search of arrowheads and other treasures. While questioning the family helped shape the direction police would take with their search, they uncovered few details that might actually help them in tracking down Gail, who at this point, it was beginning to seem more and more likely, may have been abducted. Detectives who had been out canvassing the area were a little more successful in their branch of the investigation, ultimately managing to track down 11 witnesses who had seen Gail, or a teen fitting her description, between the hours of 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. that Friday. One witness, described to reporters as an older male who knew Gail's family, reported spotting the 13-year-old around 5:30 p.m. According to the man, the team was walking west along the Notasassa Road, approximately half a mile from her home when he drove by. Another witness reported seeing Gail walking along McIntosh Road at approximately 7:30. The Notasassa Road runs east to west and intersects McIntosh Road a little over a mile east of the Joyner home. According to the second witness, Gail was spotted on McIntosh approximately 1 mile north of where it meets the Notasassa, and the teen was heading south at the time. Whether or not this was part of Gail's normal path has never been confirmed, though even if the teen had begun making her way back home, the total distance left to travel would have taken approximately an hour on foot, meaning Gail wouldn't have gotten home until approximately 8:30 p.m. at the earliest, which would still have been several hours late for dinner and out of character for her. Heading east from the Joyner home along Thanodosasa Road leads away from the lake and approximately a mile from the house. The road passes through a densely wooded area spanning several acres. At least 9 witnesses told investigators that on Friday the 22nd, they saw a girl fitting Gail's description standing beside a white car, which was parked on the side of the road along the edge of the woods. While none of these witnesses actually saw Gail enter the vehicle, they did note that when they noticed the car had gone, they no longer saw the teenager either. This, of course, led investigators to wonder if perhaps Gail had been pulled into the car by an abductor, or if perhaps she'd gotten in willingly because she might have known the driver. Much of the information about the car and its driver would be kept under wraps by investigators for several days. The search teams organized for the second official search consisted of more than 200 individuals and included deputies from Hillsborough County, members of the volunteer fire department, and local volunteers. The search was carried out on foot, horseback, boat, and was aided from the air by the sheriff's office helicopter. This search focused in on the area around the lake and family home, with dozens of groups crisscrossing through thick wooded areas while others searched the lake and surrounding canals. A local man named Hale Honey joined up in the search and brought along 2 bloodhounds in hopes that they might be able to track Gail's scent. The dogs did manage to pick up on the teen's trail, but it didn't go far. On 3 separate occasions that day, Honey took the dogs to the Joyner home. All 3 times, the dogs led him directly to a tree just across the street from the house, leading both Honey and investigators to believe that Gail had been at that spot the previous day. But with her trail dissipating so quickly, there was a chance she had gotten into a vehicle. The Tampa Times reported that on Saturday during the searches, the sheriff's office was contacted by a local woman who stated that she'd seen something very strange the day Gail vanished. According to this witness, she saw a female that she guessed to be between the ages of 12 and 14 walking near an orange grove not far from the Joyner home. The witness stated that the girl she saw was nude except for newspapers which had been wrapped around her body, and it appeared as though her hands may have been bound or restrained behind her back. Investigators noted that this particular orange grove was located near the intersection of State Road 579 and Pruitt Road, approximately 4 miles southwest of Gail's home. The search for Gail was called off as nightfall approached on Saturday, and despite the mass amount of searchers in the area covered, again, not a trace of the missing teen was found. The next morning, on Sunday, September 24th, searchers gathered in a field near the intersection of State Road 579 and Joe Ebert Road, 1 mile north of where the witness had reported seeing the partially clad teen at the orange grove. Once again, the search was conducted on foot and horseback with the aid of a helicopter while boats continued to go over Lake Thanatosasa and its surrounding canals. 9 units were dispatched from the sheriff's office to participate in the search, which intended to cover all roads and land within a 1 mile radius spanning out from the location of the orange grove near Pruitt and SR 579. Unfortunately, as had been the case the previous day, no sign of Gail was found. Following Sunday's searches, the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office announced that they were abandoning their searches of the woods and areas surrounding the lake, describing them as having been adequately searched. In addition to this, the size and scale of additional searches would also be reduced, dropping the search party from approximately 200 down to around 25. Gail had been missing at this point for just over 48 hours, but the lack of clues was leading investigators to believe that she had in fact been abducted, and the likelihood of finding her in the area was shrinking. This was not a one-sided notion, as even her father James agreed, telling the Tampa Tribune, quote, "I think if she was in this area, somebody would have found her," end quote. On Monday, September 25th, the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office announced that, following the tip they'd received about the girl seen wearing newspapers near the orange grove, they'd managed to locate her. While her name was not released, deputies noted that the girl was definitely not Gail, but a 12-year-old who had run away from the Hillsborough County Juvenile Home in nearby Sefner. When the girl was found, investigators interviewed her about where she'd been in the previous days, in hopes that she might have seen something, or perhaps even encountered Gale. Initially, the girl told police that she'd spent the night in a vacant house with another young girl who had a pet raccoon. With their interest piqued, detectives began asking further questions in hopes that the girl may have been with Gale, but things started falling apart. Major Walter Heinrich later told the Tampa Tribune, quote, "The girl was found to be a runaway from a local juvenile home, and she'd been bitten on the hand by some kind of animal. But when questioned further, the girl changed her story," end quote. 2 days later, on Wednesday, September 27th, Sergeant John Siron of the Hillsborough Sheriff's Crime Prevention Unit called a press conference to discuss new details in the case. It was at this time, 5 days after Gale's disappearance, that Sergeant Siron revealed information surrounding the vehicle and man seen in the area from which Gale vanished. Siron explained that 9 witnesses had been located who had seen a teen fitting Gale's description speaking to a man inside of a white car. Of the 9, 5 had gotten a good enough look to describe the driver. The vehicle was described as being a 1962 to 1965 white car, possibly a Chevy 2 model. If this model of car doesn't sound familiar to you, it's because a few years later the entire line was renamed and is known today as the Chevy Nova. The driver was described as being a white male with a medium to dark complexion, 28 to 30 years old, standing between 5 feet 10 inches and 6 feet tall, and weighing between 180 and 190 pounds. The man had short, dark brown hair and long sideburns. Siron explained, quote, "This car was sighted on the south shoulder of Thanodosasa Road, about 100 yards west of a small bridge. We are urging anyone who has any knowledge of the girl's whereabouts or knowledge of the automobile or its driver to call the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office Crime Prevention Unit," end quote. If accurate, the sightings of this car and driver would have placed Gale approximately 3/10 of a mile from her home. Curiously enough, Gale may not have been the only member of her family to interact with the driver of the white car that day. According to Major Heinrich, on the same Friday afternoon, Gale's older sister Linda was walking down Thanodosasa Road when a man in a white car offered her a ride, though she declined and the man did not pursue her. While there has never been a confirmation that it was the same man, most believe it's unlikely that two different men in white cars were trying to lure females into their vehicles along the road that day. Major Heinrich explained further to the Tampa Times, saying, quote, "Witnesses state they saw a car parked at the front of the bridge, with a man standing next to it on the same side of the road which Gale probably walked down, and in the other direction, a man had earlier attempted to give her sister a ride to a beach not far from their home. Sheriff's deputies, assisted by volunteers from Thanodosasa, have thoroughly searched the wooded areas around her home, and we have found nothing to indicate the child is still in the area," end quote. Unfortunately, as September came to an end, searches for Gale came to a stop, as nothing had been found to indicate where she might be. Believing she had likely been abducted, authorities sent out notices to all law enforcement agencies in the state and began looking for any cases which might share similarities. A month later, on October 22nd, local papers were all putting together articles about the girl who disappeared without a trace. Major Heinrich sat down with the Tampa Tribune to discuss progress on the investigation. He explained that deputies had gone to Greco Junior High School and spoken to Gale's teachers and classmates in their efforts to assemble a complete study of her. Asked about anyone they had interviewed outside of the school, Heinrich replied, quote, "We have interviewed between 80 and 100 people. Some have come to us with information they hoped would be helpful. Others were sought out by us and questioned," end quote. In order to spread the word about Gale's disappearance, Heinrich explained that more than 500 color posters were created showing her photo, a description, and details about it. These posters were all sent to major law enforcement agencies in the eastern and central United States. In addition, Gale was added to the NCIC. While Heinrich admitted that they had not officially ruled out the possibility that she could have run away, He explained that the circumstances of her disappearance made it seem unlikely. They did reach out to police departments in cities where relatives lived, but no one in the family had seen or heard from the 13-year-old. In what may be considered a bizarre approach, Heinrich also noted that they were tracking down reports of raccoons found in the area. He explained, quote, "Since Gail has been missing, we have checked out a total of 19 reports of dead and live raccoons found in various parts of Florida and Georgia. We couldn't be sure ourselves. We would take the animals to the girl's parents for identification. None have checked out yet." End quote. According to James and Fran, Bandit had a scar on his paw from a burn, as well as a scrape on his nose, and they believed they could identify him if he was found. Investigators hoped that if they did locate Bandit, it might give them a new direction to take their search, but they never did manage to track him down. The disappearance of their youngest daughter had a detrimental effect on James and Fran, who reported that they needed tranquilizers and sleeping pills just to get in bed at night, because every time they laid down, all they could think about was Gail. Every day, James was still going for drives around the lake area in search of his daughter, though he admitted, quote, "I don't even know what I'm looking for, but I'm looking for something," end quote. He put thousands of miles on the family car, covering every inch in a 6-mile radius around the family home. Obviously, this was also hard on the children, and in response, they banned their kids from walking around the lake. And when rumors would circulate among students about Gail being murdered, they'd pull the kids out of school for a few days. James stated that he couldn't sit still and needed to keep searching for his daughter, noting that he wouldn't believe she was dead until somebody could definitively prove it to him. At the time, he was scheduled to undergo surgery to repair the injury he'd sustained at the auto plant in Detroit, but he elected to delay the operation, feeling that he couldn't allow himself to be bedridden when he felt he should be out there looking for Gail. Simultaneously, James struggled with knowing he needed to be near. He needed to try and find Gail, but he also longed to move away, to get far from this place that was now overwhelmed with painful memories. At the same time, he couldn't imagine leaving until his daughter was found. Fran, too, felt the emotional weight of this nightmare, telling reporters that it's all she could think about. Fran explained, quote, "We live in the constant fear of somebody coming to the door with bad news. I've imagined that somebody's got her on drugs and every kind of horrible thing. We believe she got picked up, and she might have gotten into a car if she knew who was driving. She knew a lot of people. She knew people we didn't know." End quote. 6 months later, in April of 1973, the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office received a tip indicating that Gail's body might be found in a pit near the lake. On Thursday, April 5th, deputies and searchers arrived at the pit, which was apparently used as a dumping ground for locals. It was difficult to search as much of the pit was filled with water, and recent rains had caused that level to surge. Despite an exhaustive search, no trace of Gail was found, and police have never revealed the source of this tip nor what led them to believe it was a possibility. Asked about Gail's disappearance, Major Heinrich bluntly told the Times Herald, quote, "We are completely baffled. We've checked hundreds of leads and several suspects. Everyone a dead end." End quote. September of 1973 marked a full year since the 13-year-old had vanished, and by that time, leads and avenues to investigate had dried up. Despite all of their searches and the depth of the investigation, no new clues had been uncovered in the previous 11 months. 60 days later, in November, a grisly crime would lead investigators to wonder if perhaps there was a connection. On Sunday, October 28th, 1973, 11-year-old Jonathan Mark Kushner hopped on his bike to take a ride to the local 7-Eleven, where he was planning to purchase candy for himself and his little brother. He never returned, and for days the city of Tampa was gripped with fear as the hunt was on for a child predator. 30-year-old John Paul Witt eventually confessed to his wife that he and his friend, 19-year-old Gary Tillman, were responsible. Reportedly, the two men struck Jonathan in the head, knocking him off his bike, before gagging him and putting him in the trunk of a car. The child suffocated to death in that trunk. And when Witt and Tillman discovered he had died, they mutilated his body and buried him in a shallow grave near 56th Street and Sly Avenue. Witt later admitted to police that he and Tillman had been hanging out around the woods looking for a child to kill. At the time, Witt and Tillman lived in Shady Grove Trailer Park in Thanatosasa, approximately 9 miles northwest of Gale's home, or just 4 miles as the crow flies. Following their arrests, investigators and prosecutors began digging into Gale's case once again, trying to determine whether or not there could be a link between the two killers and the 13-year-old's disappearance. On Wednesday, November 3rd, investigators arrived at the Joyner home, bringing with them several items which had been removed from Witt's trailer. Believing they might be connected to Gale, the items were shown to the family, though no one was able to identify them. Investigators were never able to establish a link between Witt and Tillman and Gale's vanishing. Tillman, diagnosed with schizophrenia, confessed to the murder and was sentenced to life in prison. Witt went to trial and was found guilty, being sentenced to death. He died in the electric chair 12 years later in 1985. If you're interested in learning more about Jonathan Kushner's case, check out the podcast Alligator Candy, which was put together by his brother, David. With the likelihood minimized that Witt and Tillman had been involved in Gale's disappearance, her case began growing colder. Despite a lack of progress, the family continued to cling to their hope that she'd be found alive out there somewhere, with Fran telling the Times Herald, quote, "It's like the earth opened up and swallowed her, but I can't bring myself to put her away in a box. I can't pack up her clothes. She's alive. I have no evidence of that, but I have nothing to prove she's dead. Someday that telephone will ring and she'll say, 'Mom, come and get me.'" End quote. Unfortunately, time began passing more rapidly, and the possibility that Gale would ever be found started to fade. Soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. 1982 marked 10 years since the disappearance, and over the course of that decade, no new information had been uncovered. Sergeant Randy Latimer of the Sheriff's Office told the Tribune that detectives were routinely assigned Gale's case, but all leads had dried up years earlier. By this time, Gale's disappearance was one of the longest-standing unsolved child cases in Hillsborough County, but even investigators acknowledged that without more information, they had no avenues left to examine. That, however, was about to change, though perhaps not in a way anyone could have imagined. 2 years earlier, in April of 1980, 29-year-old Gerald Eugene Stano was arrested for cutting, beating, and using acid on a sex worker in Daytona Beach. At the time, Stano was considered a suspect in several assaults on sex workers in the area, but this time his victim was able to positively identify him. During his interrogation, Stano confessed to the murder of Mary Carol Marr, who he said he stabbed to death because she rejected his sexual advances and bled in his car. Interestingly, a later sweep of Stano's car failed to turn up any sign of blood. The next month, Stano confessed to the murder of Tony Van Haddock. In September of 1981, Stano pled guilty to the murders of Marr and Van Haddock, as well as Nancy Hurd, and was sentenced to life in prison. At the time, he also confessed to murdering Ramona Neal, Linda Hamilton, and an unidentified victim, though he was not charged with these crimes. Reportedly frustrated with not receiving enough recognition for his crimes and hoping for better prison accommodations, in October of 82, Stano confessed to several more murders, including Kathy Lee Scharf, Susan Bickrest, Mary Kathleen Muldoon, Janine Legatino, Ann Acrenew, Barbara Ann Bauer, Bonnie Jean Hughes, Diana Valick, Emily Branch, Christina Goodson, Phoebe Winston, Joan Foster, Sandra Dubose, and Dorothy Williams. Among these women, several were sex workers and all were at least 17 years old. These murders ranged from 1973 to 1980. However, Stano would go on to confess to two other murders during this interview. Firstly, He claimed to have been responsible for the murder of 12-year-old Susan Basile. Basile went missing from Port Orange, Florida on June 10, 1975. Reports of the time stated that a witness saw Basile being pulled into a dark blue van by two men that afternoon when she was walking home from her school bus stop. Stanhope, however, claimed that he had committed the crime on his own and strangled the 12-year-old. He agreed to lead police to the location where he'd left her body, but with the passage of time, new construction had built over that spot, and no trace of Basile was ever found. Whether or not Stanhope actually was responsible for Basile's disappearance has never been confirmed. In the book Blind Fury, written by Anna Flowers, it's reported that Stanhope also confessed to abducting and murdering Gail Joyner. Flowers explains that getting the confession about Basile was difficult for investigators because apparently Stanhope knew how prisoners feel about those who commit crimes against children, and he didn't want to be subjected to assaults while behind bars. Now, depending on which source you follow, Stanhope both confessed to Gail's murder, but also retracted it. In hopes of finding out whether or not he truly was responsible, in January of 1983, Stanhope arrived in the custody of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office and was asked to lead them to her body. Flowers wrote that Stanhope led police to within 1 mile of where Gail had last been seen. However, whether or not Stanhope was telling the truth, was trying to take credit for someone else's crimes, had learned about the case through the media, or was directly being led by investigators is another story all of its own. Flowers went on to write, quote, "Hillsborough County Sheriff's personnel had trouble dealing with Stanhope and his mental games. They gave him a present state examination in addition to sodium pentothal. They reported that he passed one and failed the other. Gail Joyner's body was not found, and Stanhope was returned to Florida State Prison." End quote. For the record, a present state examination is utilized to determine whether or not someone is in their right state of mind, or perhaps is being influenced by a psychological disorder, drugs, or alcohol. In addition, I should also note that Blind Fury was ghostwritten by the mother of an assistant state attorney who prosecuted Stanhope. Now, this is where things take a strange turn. While Stanhope confessed to and pled guilty to a wide range of murders, 41 victims in all, additional investigations began to raise questions. For instance, many of the victims he claimed to have killed couldn't be connected to him through any actual evidence. According to the Tampa Bay Times, in a lot of cases, no blood, fibers, stolen property, weapons, or forensic evidence could tie Stanhope to these victims. No witnesses had seen him with any of them, and evidence was so thin outside of his own confessions that a jury even deadlocked. A second jury later convicted Stanhope of the crime when another inmate testified that he'd confessed it to him. However, in 1997, that inmate, Clarence Zack, told reporter Arthur Nash that he had lied about this interaction with Stanhope, and he'd also lied when he'd testified in other cases, claiming that his testimony was put together with the assistance of two former prosecutors who offered him better treatment in exchange for his testimony. In one instance, Zack testified against Wilton Dodge, who would go on to serve 22 years for rape before lawyers from the Innocence Project proved that his DNA didn't match that found on the victim. In the case of Kathy Lee Scharf, in 2007, the FBI ran tests which confirmed that male hair found on her body did not match Stanhope. However, this information was never presented by his defense attorney, and the hairs were subsequently destroyed following Stanhope's execution in 1998. In at least one other instance, another person would later be prosecuted for one of the crimes to which Stanhope confessed. Mark Olive, one of Stanhope's lawyers, described his former client not as a serial killer, but as a serial confessor. As it turns out, Stanhope's lawyers were not the only ones who think he may have confessed to a slew of crimes for which he was not responsible. Jim Gadberry, the former Daytona Beach police officer who initially arrested Stanhope in 1980, believes former Detective Paul Crow, who got many of the confessions from Stano, played a larger role in potentially leading Stano to the information they needed to confirm his confessions. Gadberry told the Times, quote, "The information was fed to him, and all he did was acknowledge it. He didn't come up with any information on his own," end quote. Now, it's interesting to note that in many cases, there wasn't enough evidence outside of Stano's own confessions to tie him to the crimes for which he received 8 life sentences and 3 death sentences. For his part, former Detective Crow has said any accusation that he fed information to Stano is ludicrous, and he feels that the former officer Gadberry made up the story of him leading Stano's confessions out of a personal vendetta. There seems to be somewhat of a split, as some officers agree with Gadberry, believing that Crow did in fact feed details to Stano, while others have argued that Gadberry, who became a minister after leaving the force, was looking to gain some level of notoriety for himself. Whether or not Stano was responsible for all of the murders to which he confessed is a conversation for another day. However, I do think it's worth noting that when it comes to the murder of Gail Joyner, there doesn't appear to be any actual evidence to link him to the crime. While it's been reported that Stano led investigators to within 1 mile of where Gail vanished, many believe that, as someone living in Florida, he may have simply been aware of the case from hearing it on the news. Stano's crimes took place predominantly around Gainesville, Daytona Beach, and Port Orange, though he did commit murders in Pennsylvania and New Jersey as well. The closest of the Florida locations is more than 130 miles from Thanatosasa. Not to mention, the description of the man seen speaking to Gail that Friday in 1972 doesn't really match Stano, nor does the vehicle description match what he owned at the time, described to have been a green Plymouth Duster. Beyond that, tracking Stano can be difficult, but he's noted as having moved to Florida in 1973, months after Gail's disappearance, though I should state he did visit his grandparents in Florida previously. Several websites state that in his confession, Stano provided information that only the killer could have known, though what information has never been revealed, and considering that Gail has never been found, no one actually knows how she may have been killed or where it might have happened. When reaching out to the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office, they note only that there have been 3 separate people who have confessed to Gail's murder, but that the case remains open and therefore they cannot share their files. While some believe Stano is in fact Gail's killer, others aren't so sure, and as such, she's not listed on his official list of victims. Susan Basile is, though in her case, they have no evidence that he committed that crime outside of his confession, and he was never charged in connection to her disappearance. Much like Gail, Susan Basile's body has never been found. In addition to Stano, I mentioned that 2 other people confessed to Gail's murder. While I'd like to share more with you about those confessions, I can't. Neither person has ever been publicly named, and what information they might have provided has never been released. It seems, if indeed one of them might be responsible for the crime, as is the case with Stano, investigators never uncovered enough evidence to officially charge anyone. Sadly, coverage of Gail's case seems to fall off by the mid-1980s, and in the more than 3 decades since then, nothing new has ever been reported. There's been no new evidence, no new suspects, nothing to reveal what became of the sweet, friendly, and adventurous 13-year-old who left her Thanatosasa home in September of 1972 and never returned. When last seen, Gail Lorraine Joyner was described as being a white female with blondish-brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet tall and weighing 100 pounds. She has freckles on her face and a small scar on her cheek. Gail was last seen wearing blue Levi's brand jeans and a navy blue pullover shirt with white stripes. She was not wearing shoes. She was spotted by multiple witnesses along both Thanatosasa Road and McIntosh Road between the hours of 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. on the evening of Friday, September 22, 1972. At the time of her disappearance, Gail was 13 years old, and if alive today, she would be turning 63 in July. Her pet raccoon, Bandit, disappeared with her, and was never found. Multiple witnesses reported seeing Gale speaking to the driver of a white car believed to be a 1962 to 1965 Chevy Nova near the woods approximately 0.3 miles to the east of her home. The driver of the car has been described as a white male with a medium to dark complexion, 28 to 30 years old, standing between 5 feet 10 inches and 6 feet tall and weighing between 180 and 190 pounds. The man had short, dark brown hair and long sideburns. Sadly, tragedy has haunted Gale's family in the years after her disappearance. 3 of her brothers have since passed away. James, 2 years later in 1974, Randy in 1985, and Terry just last year in 2021. Her father, James, passed in 2002 at the age of 66, having never left the Nota Sasa without finding his beloved daughter. Gale's mother, Fran, passed away in 2020 at the age of 82, never learning what became of her daughter, and always hoping that someday she would find that truth. Asked about Gale's disappearance after so many years, Fran replied, quote, "It's bad to lose a child, but when you lose one the way we lost Gale, it's the most unfair thing that can happen to you in your life. You think God is mad at you. There's not a time I don't drive down that road and I don't think of her, or I don't look at those woods and think she'll walk out. It's a horrible thing to live with. My brain tells me Gale is dead, but my heart holds on to hope. It's been really baffling, like the world opened up and swallowed Gale. Time heals all hurts. I can't completely put Gale to rest, but maybe in time they'll solve it." I love that sound. The sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses, so startups, upstarts, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. I love how Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed from down the street to around the globe. Like mine, Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility, powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/trace, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/trace right now. shopify.com/trace. Do you ever wonder why free trials renew without your consent? It's a business scam out to get you. Don't let greedy corporations pocket your money. Download Truebill to take control of your subscriptions. Truebill is the new app that helps you identify and stop paying for subscriptions you don't need, want, or simply forgot about. On average, people save up to $720 a year with Truebill. Because companies make subscriptions hard to cancel, Truebill makes it incredibly simple. Just link your accounts and Truebill will cancel your unwanted subscriptions in one tap. And your Truebill concierge is there when you need them to cancel unwanted subscriptions, so you don't have to. Before I started using Truebill, I had no idea how much money I was losing to subscriptions I didn't even know I had. Month after month, I was paying out for services I wasn't even using, just throwing money down the drain. I love Truebill. They save me several hundred dollars a month. I use Truebill, and you should too. Truebill has over 2 million users and has helped save over $100 million. Like Matthew B., who says, quote, In a matter of seconds, I saved $660 for the year on my DirecTV bill, saved $120 for the year on my SiriusXM bill, saved $840 a year on car insurance. End quote. Don't fall for subscription scams. Start canceling today at Truebill.com/trace. Go right now, Truebill.com/trace. It could save you thousands a year. Truebill.com/trace. The disappearance of Gail Joyner is a sad, disturbing, and frustrating case to dig into. It's one of those cases where we're reminded how poorly these situations were handled back in the 70s, although to the credit of investigators in this case, at least they dismissed the likelihood of her having run away early on. Regardless, the investigation was never able to turn up much information, or at least, they never turned up much information that was released to the public. There's always this debate amongst true crime community members about how long departments should keep information secret following a crime. Obviously, there's good reasons to keep things under wraps. To protect the integrity of the investigation, to be able to confirm someone's involvement based on information they give which isn't public, to keep potential suspects in the dark about what exactly police know. However, after nearly 50 years, is it really helping to keep these files locked away? That's not for me to answer. I'd never want to do anything to jeopardize a case and give a perpetrator an easy out, but there are some cases where it's difficult to understand why things are kept secret for as long as they are. If police believe that Stano, for instance, was responsible for Gail's death, why keep things confidential 24 years after he was executed? If they believe it was one of the two unnamed persons who also confessed to the murder, I'd love to know if either of them is still alive. If so, that may show that investigators believe one of those people did actually commit the crime, but they lack the evidence to make an arrest. It just seems like one of those situations where, by the time all the information comes out, it's going to be too late to arrest anyone in the first place because everyone associated with this case is going to have passed away. If you go out to research this case, if you've got your own questions and want to try and find the answers, you're going to run into the same roadblocks I did. Almost all of the information available about Gail's disappearance came out between 1972 and 1982. Once you pass the mid-80s, it becomes almost impossible to find new articles, interviews with police, or any updates at all. It seems like they never had a lot of information to begin with, and after they spoke to witnesses about the man in the white car, they ran right into a dead end. Outside of Stano and the other two who have confessed, there haven't been any new details released, new evidence revealed, or seemingly any progress on this case. Being faced with that, we don't have a lot to work with in terms of theories, as the only real theory that was ever purported was that Gail was abducted that Friday afternoon. So I suppose the best way to go about this is to look through what we know and try to connect any dots that might be out there. We'll begin with the presumption that Gail was abducted by someone who's never been named or identified, then we'll move into Stano and the other two unidentified confessors. I think from the beginning of researching this case, it seemed fairly obvious that Gail had been the victim of an abduction. From the description of the vehicle and the man driving it, to the highly unlikely scenario that she'd run off, it was really the only possibility that made any sense. I think one of the major questions that lingers for so many people looking into Gail's disappearance is, was she abducted by someone she knew? Was she specifically targeted by someone? Or was the abduction more of a random crime? Initially, Gail's family were firm in their belief that she wouldn't have gotten into a car with a stranger, and they believed it had to be someone she knew. The first issue I had with that is Gail's sister, Linda, also was approached by a man in a white car that afternoon who tried to lure her in. She turned him down and continued on her way, and the man didn't try to pursue her. According to everything we know, Linda didn't recognize the driver, or if she did, investigators elected not to share that detail, which doesn't make a lot of sense in the grand scheme of things. That might make you want to dismiss the idea that Gail knew her abductor, but as her mother confirmed through interviews, Gail was a very outgoing young woman who knew a lot of people that her family didn't. She'd chat with strangers and make friends fairly easily, so it's entirely possible that this person knew Gail, and she knew him, but no one else in the family did. The problem for me comes about with the incident involving Linda. If this was someone looking to abduct Gail, and it was someone she knew, then why would they be trying to lure Linda into the car hours before Gail went out for her walk? I think the way this situation played out, it seems more likely that whoever was driving that white car was out looking for someone to grab, whether it was Gail, Linda, or another young woman in that area. We know that Lake Thanota Sasa was a popular place for locals to hang out, so it's not out of the realm of possibility the man could have been stalking around that area periodically looking for a victim. Being there in the hours after school let out may also suggest that the suspect was specifically targeting younger women, between the ages of 12 and 16, for instance. While through today's lens, it may seem ridiculous to imagine some guy sitting on the side of the road could convince someone to get into his car, but you've got to remember that 1972 was a very different time. Hitchhiking and taking rides with strangers was somewhat commonplace. Oftentimes, we look back at people and wonder how they could have been so cavalier with their own lives, but they lived in a different world. They hadn't yet been engulfed by the 24-hour news cycle that focuses in hard on abductions, at least in some cases. Statistics weren't being accurately kept, and in a lot of ways, missing children fell through the cracks. If a 14-year-old went hitchhiking and never came back, unless they found a body, in most cases, they just chalked it up as a runaway situation. People didn't know exactly how dangerous it was, and while it may seem foolish to say it today, back then, words like serial killer, child predator, psychopath, they weren't common. I've talked to a lot of people who feel like the world has gotten so much more dark and so much more dangerous since the 60s and 70s, and while I'm inclined to agree, I can't help but wonder, has the world truly turned darker, or was it always this dark, but we were less informed and educated about it, so it seemed a little brighter? Gail's parents believe she never would have gotten into a car with a stranger. While they would have known their daughter better than anyone else, I don't necessarily think it's entirely impossible that this could have happened, but maybe not in a way we'd imagine. Instead of Gail being asked if she needed a ride and just nonchalantly hopping in, we all know that child predators can be very smart about the way they approach and manipulate their victims. Maybe he claimed to know her parents. Maybe he alleged to be a teacher at her school. Hell, maybe the guy said he'd lost his dog and he needed help finding it. There's a myriad of ways Gail could have been tricked into getting into that car. Then I think we have to consider Bandit the raccoon. According to her father, Gail often met people who were drawn to the raccoon and wanted to talk about him, pet him, ask questions, and being super proud of her pet, Gail was more than happy to entertain these conversations. I've often wondered if the man may have asked to see Bandit. Gail hands him over, and then the man threatens to harm the raccoon unless she gets in the car. It doesn't even have to have been that aggressive. He could have simply said, "Hey, I have a pet raccoon too. Come in the car. I live just down the street. Maybe our pets can be friends." The fact of the matter is, if Gail did get into that car of her own volition, she may have done so under false pretenses. Then again, the man could have threatened her or frightened her into getting into the car. Then there's always the possibility that he just grabbed her. Once she got close enough to the car for him to reach out, it doesn't sound like it would have been difficult to lure her over by asking about Bandit. Gail was 5 feet tall and 100 pounds, and while she could have put up a hell of a struggle, it's unlikely that a 6 foot tall, 185-pound man was going to struggle too much. Hell, it could have even been something similar to the approach of Ted Bundy, for instance. Maybe when she gets close enough, he hits her over the head or uses some other method to subdue her. He could have had a gun that he pointed at her. I think what makes it strange is that at least 9 people saw Gail talking to this guy, but no one saw her get in the car, no one saw any kind of a struggle, no one heard any screaming. Maybe this lends more credence to the possibility that Gail did know the man in some way. I can't help but think about school in this case. 3 weeks before her disappearance, Gail began attending Greco Junior High School, approximately 8 miles to the west of her home. Members of the school staff would have had access to her information, to know where she lived. If it was a teacher who interacted with her, 3 weeks was more than enough time to learn about Bandit and to discover that she took walks with him every day, usually by herself. We know investigators went to the school and questioned teachers and students about Gail, but it doesn't sound like they approached it from an angle that someone there could have been responsible. I'd love to know if any male teachers drove a similar car, if they resigned, transferred, or moved away within the next year, or if any of them later ran into issues with law enforcement as relates to children. It's a sad reality, but when someone's a child predator, a teaching job's an easy way to have unlimited access to children without drawing suspicion. And in 1972, people weren't nearly as aware of these kinds of activities. So, certainly Gail could have been targeted. She could have been grabbed. She could have known her assailant. She could have been coaxed or threatened into the car. It's a sad reality that almost anything is possible in this case. So turning away from a question of a stranger, let's look at the only person who's ever been named as potentially being linked to this case, Gerald Stano. I'm not going to dive into Stano's history or dig much into how many of the 41 murders he confessed to were ones that he actually committed. Let's try to focus in around how he may or may not have been involved in Gail's disappearance. The first issue you're going to run into with Stano is that he graduated from high school in Pennsylvania in 1973 at the age of 21. He was left back three times during his school career. So you may be wondering, how is it possible to abduct Gail in September of 72 if he was attending and living in Pennsylvania in 73? Well, the truth is, we don't really know exactly where Stano was from day to day. Yes, he attended school in Pennsylvania, but he'd also been sent to stay with his grandparents in Florida at different times, so it's entirely possible he could have been in the South in September of 72. That being said, his main stalking areas in Florida were around Gainesville, Port Orange, and Daytona Beach, all of which were well over 100 miles from Thanota Sassa. Sure, it's possible he decided to veer off the beaten path on this particular day, but what are the chances he's going to wind up on a rural road around a lake hoping that he runs into someone to abduct? According to Stano, he usually selected his victims in one of two ways. Either they were sex workers who he could easily convince to get into his car, or he'd look for lone women walking in areas where no one else was around. That would surely fit Gail, but how much? Nine witnesses seeing her speaking to the man in the white car doesn't exactly sound like no one else was around, but we don't actually know where the witnesses were. Did they just happen to drive by, or were they walking down the road, or standing in their driveway? We can't confirm anything as relates to their specific perspective, but if they were drivers, then it wouldn't be difficult to keep the conversation going with Gail long enough to wait until the road is clear. The problem is a lack of evidence. Let me put this another way. Had they charged Stano with Gail's abduction and murder and he didn't confess, could they have taken it to trial? Probably not. If he doesn't confess, then they have nothing to connect him to the crime. No sightings, no physical evidence, no reports of him bragging about it. The fact of the matter is, until Stano says Gail's name, he's never considered a potential person of interest. Unfortunately, due to the murky waters of his confessions, we really have no way of knowing if he merely brought Gail up or if he was directly asked about her. I do think it's interesting to note that in the book Blind Fury, author Anna Flowers says that Stano did not want to be known for murdering children, fearing reprisal from other inmates. But he doesn't retract his confession about Susan Basile, only his confession about Gail. If you're willing to admit to murdering one child, is it really going to be easier on you than if you confessed to two? It just never made any sense to me. So let's look at the facts. Stano claims to have killed women in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Florida throughout his life. While he claims to have committed murder as early as 1969, specifically confessing to killing two women in New Jersey that year when he would have been 18 years old. There was never enough evidence to charge him with those crimes, though, and so Stano's murder officially began in 1973 when he's 22 years old. According to the FBI, Stano moved to Florida with his parents in 73, and there's nothing which directly links him to any crimes in Florida prior to 73 outside of his confessions to killing Susan Basile and Gail Joyner. So, Stano apparently only killed when he was drinking or using drugs, something he began doing in his early 20s. In 73, he graduated high school, moved into a local motel, and began working at a hospital, but was fired for stealing money from coworkers. He enrolled in a computer school after high school, though how long he actually attended isn't recorded, and given that he moved to Florida that same year, I can't imagine he was there very long. When he did move to Florida, he settled in the area of Ormond Beach, approximately 148 miles northeast of Thanatassassa. Officially, for the crimes for which he was found guilty, they all took place in central or eastern Florida, with nothing tying him to areas to the west like Tampa or Thanatassassa. Stano's been linked to two separate vehicles during his time in Florida, a red Gremlin and a green Plymouth Duster, which was his most treasured possession. Reportedly, Stano kept the car in immaculate shape, and it was while driving this vehicle that he committed the majority of his murders. I haven't been able to find anything linking him to a white Chevy Nova, but that doesn't mean he couldn't have had access to one. Finding exact information about how Stano would have appeared in 72 hasn't been easy either. A mugshot from 69 shows him with very short dark hair and short sideburns. Photos of him following his 1980 arrest are similar. His hair and sideburns remain shortened by this time, in his early 30s, he's wearing glasses. According to prison records, Stano stood 5 feet 9 inches tall, which could fit into witness descriptions who described him as being 5'10 to 6 feet tall. I mean, it's only an inch difference on the shorter side. Witnesses placed the age of the suspect as being between 28 and 30. Stano would have been 21 in 72. However, in his 1969 mugshot, you can see that his hairline was already receding, and so it's possible if he was the man in the white car, witnesses may have guessed him to have been older than he was. So I guess what you have to ask yourself is, could Stano have been responsible? I don't think you can rule him out by any means, but I do think it's worth noting that without a confession, there's no way you'd get a conviction. I don't think most prosecutors would have ever charged him with this crime if the arrest had to be based purely on evidence, as, in all reality, they don't have any evidence linking him to Gail's disappearance. I don't put a lot of weight into the idea that he was able to lead investigators to within a mile of where Gail vanished from. I don't know exactly how it went down, but unless he led police from the sheriff's office directly to the road that Gail was seen on, it isn't difficult to imagine he could have merely been brought to the area. He seemingly couldn't point out where he disposed of Gail's body, or if he did, they couldn't find her. And what alleged details did he give that only the killer would know have never been revealed? Why, you might ask? Well, because the case is still open. You'd imagine if he really did have details that only the killer knew, investigators might have been a little more inclined to pursue this further. If we dismiss Stano at this point, all we're left with is two nameless individuals who also confessed to Gail's murder. We know nothing about these people. Whether they're even men is a question which hasn't been answered. So, was it merely people saying they did it and failing to deliver any additional information to support their confessions? Or did they have some details that made them seem like a possible consideration? Again, I wish I knew. But as of this time, that information's not public. All I can really say about this angle is, if the police could have tied either of these people to Gail's disappearance, I think they would have. Since that didn't happen, since we've never been told their names, I'm inclined to believe that police had enough reasonable doubt to not move forward with any attempt to arrest or prosecute them. Unfortunately, this is where we too run into a dead end. There's never been anything else to work with. No named suspects, no fingerprints, blood, no trail, nothing. A 13-year-old girl takes her pet raccoon out for a walk and never comes home. Nearly 50 years later, and there are as many unanswered questions as there were on that fall day in 1972. A child's life was stolen. A family was splintered, and two loving parents went to their graves never seeing justice done, never learning their daughter's fate, and never believing that their days would pass without some questions being answered. Sadly, as things stand today, unless new evidence is found, someone confesses and can actually prove it, or Gail's body is found, the disappearance of Gail Joyner will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Gail Joyner, the Tampa Tribune and Tampa Bay Times had the most thorough coverage. You can also check out Blind Fury by Anna Flowers, which focuses more on Stano than anything else, but does mention Gail. You can also look into her case, as her NCMEC number is 775-400. Her Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office case number is 72-41739, and her NAMIS number is MP4632. It's noted on her NAMIS page that there have been 15 exclusions conducted comparing her DNA, which is on file, to Jane Doe's in the area. If you have any information about the disappearance of Gail Joyner, please contact the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office at 813-247-8200. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Ann Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brickeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. I want to again thank you for listening to this episode, and I have a small favor I'd like to ask. I created a survey about the show. It takes less than 2 minutes to complete. I'm planning to make some adjustments moving towards episode 200, and I'd love your input. You can find the link to the survey in the show notes or on trace-evidence.com. That's going to wrap up episode 186, The Disappearance of Gail Joyner. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.